Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming for this Oslo Metropolitan Digital Journalism Focus Seminar. And today we have the great pleasure of moving on with our program and listening to Orin Tenenbaum from the University of Texas, Austin. And he is building up his research profile as an emerging PhD candidate and future scholar with a variety of different publications, some which have reached great engagement in the industry, publishing with IRG and studies that have been picked up by the World Association of Newspapers. Today, Ori will present a paper or an article that will be published in New Media and Society next year, and which some colleagues of mine have had the pleasure to see in different stages evolve throughout the year. It's called Co-Constructing Journalistic Knowledge with the Audience, a Case Study of Sustained Reciprocity. And I would say that this is a quite remarkable case study in many ways of positive and good forms of participatory journalism involving non-proprietary platforms in all stages of the news production process. And I will myself go back to this study many times in my own work, and I'm sure many others will too. And I'm glad that you're here to present it. Many thanks for coming.
Thank you, Oscar. Hello, everyone. Can you hear me well?
Yeah.
It is my honor and pleasure to be here today and talk to you about my research. I enjoyed hearing about your research, and I would love to hear your thoughts about the content of this talk. This way we may be able to co-construct knowledge, drawing on the title of my talk. The talk, as Oscar mentioned, is based on an article that is expected to be published in New Media and Society. The article focuses on a case study of journalist audience sustained reciprocity on a messaging chat application. But before talking about it, I will give you a brief background about myself and some of the big questions I am investigating in my research in general, not only in the chat app study. Then I will lay theoretical foundations of the chat app study. Specifically, I will talk about epistemologies of news, how journalists know what they know and communicate knowledge claims. I will talk about participatory journalism that involves audience members, reciprocal journalism that emphasizes mutual exchanges between journalists and audiences. I will also address journalism as a conversation as opposed to journalism as a lecture. Then I will delve into the case study. I will tell you what my colleague, Dr. Netta Kligler-Vilenchik from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and I did, how we did it, and what we found. I will also address something that was not explicitly addressed in the article, media literacy. I know that some of you are studying media literacy, and you may be interested to hear about it in the context of chat application. Then I will discuss what it all means for journalism and journalism studies. I will tell you about a new project in which I'm involved and directions for future studies. And more than anything, I will be happy to hear your comments, suggestions, questions, whatever is on your mind. So this is our agenda. A little bit about myself. As Oscar mentioned, I am a doctoral candidate in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. I also work there as a research associate with a center called the Center for Media Engagement. The core mission of the center is to provide research-based techniques for engaging audiences in democratically beneficial and commercially viable ways. And before I was a student and a researcher in the United States, I worked as a journalist in Israel. My journalistic career started as an intern at a print newspaper called Yediot Ahronot. It's a nationally circulated newspaper. At the time, it was the most circulated newspaper in Israel. I had the privilege to spend time in the news desk and experience the logic of the print newspaper, how news pages were produced, how they may sometimes change shortly before the deadline due to unexpected events. Later, I edited pages in the business section of that newspaper. And then I moved to a very popular website in Israel. It's called Walla. It's not affiliated to a newspaper. It's a digital native outlet. I was a news editor there and later promoted as the head of the news desk. So it means I decided what would be the main headlines and what stories would get prominence. And I experienced there what Nikki describes in her book about the New York Times, the core values of online journalism, immediacy, interactivity, and participation. I was particularly fascinated to see in real time, or almost in real time, how audience members engage with the content we produced. At the same time, it was interesting to see how some of the things I did at the website were the exact same things that I had done in the print newspaper. So with this experience and university's degrees in communication and political science, I moved to the United States to pursue my PhD in journalism. Why am I telling you all this? Because it may help understand what has contributed to shaping my research today and the questions I'm interested in. So one question is, how do news organizations and individual journalists hybridize older and newer media logics in different political and cultural contexts? By media logics, I mean norms, behaviors, organizational forms. When the concept of media logic was first introduced, I think in 1979, it was a logic in the singular, one logic, but since then scholars have talked about different logics, and older and newer logics can be layered into each other, can be hybridized. There are various combinations of old and new, and if we identify these combinations, we may be able to better understand power relations among different actors and publics. So, for example, for my dissertation, I'm now interviewing social media editors who work for news organizations in the United States and Israel. I asked them about the ways in which they construct messages, how they interact with audience members, how they deal with algorithms that are not transparent and keep changing. And then I find commonalities and differences between the countries and try to make sense of them. Another example, I examined how individual journalists use Twitter in different contexts. One of them was the Gaza-Israel conflict. And I found that the war journalism on Twitter was very similar to the traditional war journalism we know, but there was also something new. Journalists who were members of one of the conflicting parties, the Israeli journalists, were more likely than their international colleagues to use Twitter affordances to disseminate criticism about the conflict, including criticism about their own party, their own government. They did not write the criticism, but they took an active part in disseminating the messages. And this was a different behavior from the behavior of their international colleagues, at least in that context. Another question I'm very interested in is, how do audience members engage with, accede to, negotiate, or contest media? This is part of what Sonia Livingston calls the participatory paradigm in audience research. So, for example, I examined patterns of clicking and commenting on news, and I found significant differences between the most popular news and the most discussed news. People were more likely to comment on political issues and controversial issues, but they were more likely to consume sensational topics such as crime and curiosity arousing elements, what I call such as violence. But audience engagement can occur at different stages of the news production process. And this brings me to the case study, the study I conducted with Netta Klingler-Vilenchik involves audience participation in knowledge production, and it also involves a journalist who hybridized older and newer norms and behaviors on a non-proprietary platform, as Oscar mentioned. So let's talk about it a little bit. In 2015, a prominent Israeli journalist and political blogger, Tal Schneider, you can see her here, opened for her followers an instant messaging group on the application WhatsApp. The group includes around 100 people. Each of them had to pay subscription fee to become a member, 15 Israeli shekels. There are about 34 Norwegian krons, from what I checked, around $4. Members of the group receive and share news updates, behind-the-scenes information. They take part in interviewing politicians. They conduct vibrant discussions around the news with the journalists and among themselves. And on her part, the journalist not only receives monetary support, but she also benefits from audience participation in the production of knowledge. We're using this case study to show how mutual exchanges between a journalist and her loyal audience members can occur in a continuous manner and over time, and how these exchanges allow a continuous co-construction of journalistic knowledge. But several theoretical concepts before I say what exactly we did, theoretical concept that helped us think about this case study, epistemologies of news that can be understood as the ways in which journalists know what they know, and also the ways in which journalists evaluate, articulate, and justify knowledge claims. And we're not conducting a philosophical inquiry into the nature of true knowledge. We're adopting a sociological lens to study the production of knowledge. And using this lens, Ekstrom defined epistemology as the rules, routines, and institutionalized procedures that operate within a social setting and decide the form of the knowledge produced and the knowledge claims expressed or implied. So research on journalistic epistemology has shown a tension between the perceived roles of journalists, such as being objective, and their actual practices. So considering the large body of research on perceived roles of journalism, of journalists, Odenbrink called for more empirical insights into journalist epistemic practices, or what he called epistemic work of journalists. And this is particularly important in view of digital affordances in the digital age. News production is not limited to the news desk. It can occur, it occurs in a news ecosystem. And at least in contexts where public expression is not severely restricted, audience members have agency to create, to disseminate, to interpret content. So it's worth examining, it's worth investigating the role that audience members play in these epistemic practices, the role they play in shaping the epistemologies of news. And journalism scholars and practitioners have used different concepts to describe audience involvement in news-related processes. This book was mentioned today as the most cited book in the journal Digital Journalism, right?
Yeah,
that's the one. So citizen in journalism, for example, refers to when audience members, everyday citizens, produce news entirely by themselves. You can describe it as citizen journalism. But when they contribute to news-related processes within a frame designed by professionals, we can see it as participatory journalism. And Jane Singer and her colleagues adopted this term, suggesting that it captures the idea of collective and collaborative action. People inside and outside the newsroom are engaged in communicating not only to, but also with one another. In doing so, they're all participating in the ongoing processes of creating a news website and building a multifaceted community. You can see that the focus here is on proprietary platforms. This was published in 2011. But to assess the relative openness of news outlets to audience participation in the news, these scholars outlined five stages of the news production process. The first stage is access and observation. I'm sure most of you know that, but I will talk about it anyway for those who are not familiar with the precise stages, because we construct our findings based on these stages. At the level, at the stage of access observation, a source material for a story is generated, for example, an eyewitness account or audiovisual contribution. The second stage is selection filtering. This is the gatekeeping stage where decisions are made on what should be reported or published, processing and editing. This is the stage of creating the story, including writing or recording and editing. The distribution stage is the stage of disseminating the story, making it available for consumption. And the last stage is interpretation, where when the story is opened up to discussion and comments. And these scholars interviewed editors in 10 Western democracies, and they found that users were somewhat involved in the initial stage, the access observation, and they were mostly involved in the interpretation stage, but they had little impact on the stages in between, because journalists were reluctant to relinquish their gatekeeping role as professionals who decide what constitutes news. The participation varied across stages. At the first stage, audience members could submit news tips, photos, or other materials. The second stage was the most close to audience participation, by far the most close. At the processing editing stage, audience members had opportunities to create some stories at the local level, not so much at the national level. And when they had these opportunities, they focused on soft content, such as lifestyle issues, not so much hard news. Distribution, when the study was conducted, audience members had limited opportunities to be involved. But of course, since then, news websites incorporated social sharing features, so there are many more opportunities. And interpretation, again, by far the most open for participation. Audience members were invited to have their say by commenting. And as Seth Lewis described it, journalists experienced this tension between professional control and open participation. They have struggled to reconcile this tension. But on non-proprietary platforms, non-controlled environments such as Facebook and Twitter, the lines of separation between journalists and audience may be more blurred, and this possibly allows greater openness to user participation. Journalists and other users can collaborate in curation and creation of content. We saw this during the Arab Spring and on other occasions. And this is a prominent case, a collaboration between NPR's Andy Carvin and his Twitter followers. Andy Carvin was the senior product manager for online communities at National Public Radio in the United States. He was also considered a central node in the information network about the uprisings. And he worked with his followers to gather and confirm information. He did it by, this is his account, he did it by asking them questions, by replying to their questions, by creating hashtags to build discourse. So this is an example of how journalism can be more reciprocal, can involve mutual exchanges. Though the exchanges were limited to specific events, it was an ad hoc collaboration to a large extent. And this brings me to the concepts of reciprocity and reciprocal journalism. Reciprocity can be understood as an exchange between two actors or more, typically for mutual benefit. This is an important feature of social life. It allows to establish relationships, to build a community cohesion. And Seth Lewis, Avery Holton, and Mark Coddington proposed the concept of reciprocal journalism, journalism that involves mutual exchanges between journalists and audiences. And they suggested it could occur at three levels. So there's the direct level, actor A gives something to B, and B gives something to C. The second one is indirect, A gives something to B, who gives something to C. And this is an exchange intended for community benefit. And when these two forms of exchanges occur continuously over time, we have sustained reciprocity and suggesting future interactions and benefits. And in turn, they suggested that lasting forms of reciprocity may deepen collective trust, social capital, and overall connectedness. Now, reciprocal journalism is not a wholly new kind of journalism. It just points to the unrealized potential for participatory journalism with mutual benefits in mind. And it seems to be rare in journalism. And we're showing in our study that sustained reciprocity can occur through a continuous conversation. Writers on public journalism called for more dialogue between journalists and audience members, suggesting moving from journalism as a lecture to journalism as a conversation. And I provide a definition here. Journalism is a conversation, the manner and or degree to which interpersonal reciprocal exchanges between journalists and everyday citizens enhance news work on matters of public import for the common good. And this kind of journalism can occur in different spaces. In our study, we're focusing on the chat application WhatsApp that can be seen as an alternative to public-facing social media platforms. It allows one-to-one, some-to-some, and many-to-many conversations. And this is why it can be seen as a unique combination of mass and interpersonal communication channels. I know it is not WhatsApp is not very dominant in countries such as the United States or Norway, from what I checked at the Reuters Institute report. But according to WhatsApp, it has more than a billion daily active users, and it is very popular in various countries, including my home country, Israel. But this is just information. So Reuters report, their latest report, looked at 37 countries. 44%, this is the aggregated data, said they were using WhatsApp for any purpose. 16% on average said they were using it for news. And this doubled in 4 years. And in many countries, it's even higher than that. In Israel, for example, according to estimation, it is used by 93% of people who have smartphones. And there are various WhatsApp groups, kindergarten parents, school children, workplaces. It has gained immense popularity. In our study, this is another slide from the Reuters report, those who said they were using Facebook and WhatsApp for news, what exactly they're doing. In orange, you can see Facebook. In blue, WhatsApp. So 30% of those who said they were using WhatsApp for news said they looked at news headlines, but not clicked for further information. 42% said they clicked on a link to get more information. 24% said they took part in a private discussion about a news story. And 16% said they took part in a group set up to discuss a particular news topic. In our study, we're focusing on a journalistic WhatsApp group, and we're proposing a new term called MISO Newspace. I think someone mentioned MISO level earlier, so MISO means in between, an online space occurring between the private and public realms where a group of people are involved in news-related processes. And we present this term in the article. And we're asking several research questions. How can journalistic knowledge be discursively co-constructed with the audience through digital media platforms? In what way does the MISO Newspace afford sustained reciprocity? And what are the implications for the journalist-audience relationships and the epistemologies of news production? So how did we do it? What did we do? We use a multi-method approach. I actually do a lot of quantitative research, but in this project, this project was purely qualitative. We used three pillars of qualitative research and analysis of the conversations on the WhatsApp group. I'll tell you more about it. Analysis of the journalist blog, and also interviews with the journalist and members of the group. So we collected data from 2016, all messages that were posted in the group. Of course, we received an approval from Institutional Review Board at the Hebrew University. We received consent from the journalist, and we posted messages in the group identifying as researchers. And we said that if people do not want to participate, they can send us a message, and they will not be quoted in any way. They will not be involved in the research. No one has asked to opt out. And we posted these messages from time to time. It wasn't just one time. So we got all the messages, more than 100,000. And we sampled the 2 days per month with the highest number of messages. So this resulted in 24 days and more than 14,000 messages. So this allowed us to reach saturation in terms of understanding audience involvement in epistemic practices. We also looked at posts in the journalist's blog. We looked at the posts that were published on the days we analyzed and the days before and after. So a three window day so that we can trace some influences. And we also interviewed Schneider and 10 participants for each interview lasted from 45 to 90 minutes. We had, think people from various ages of 32 to 67, most of them we asked them about their motivations and experiences and perceptions. You can see here the total number of messages in orange. In blue, you can see the messages we actually use, so 2 days in each month. So first, some descriptive findings. The ground rule for participation. This is a group that discusses politics only, and the journalist mentions from time to time no sports. She doesn't want to hear about sports. No posting of long copy-pasted messages because she says it's hard to read them on small screens. No posting of snap, for example, photos from terrorist attacks. We saw that the journalist takes a significant part in the discussion, 23% of the messages. You can see in blue the total number of messages, in orange the messages posted by Schneider. Other than that, the participation was relatively open. We didn't see a lot of policing apart from these rules, and I will later talk about collective interviews that involve specific rules, but we'll get to that. So we saw that there's a continuous conversation in the Mesio new space, to use Schneider's words, nonstop, ongoing, changing, and ideally quick pace. It's also continuous in the sense that it exists for years over time. At least in our sample, there were more than, an average of more than 500 messages per day. Various issues in the news were discussed. The most common ones were related to national politics and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You could have live updates from a terrorist attack to gossiping about Israeli members of parliament. On certain days, we saw discussions round the clock, for example, during the presidential election the debates. She kept posting, and there were discussions in Israel. It was 4 a.m. In the morning. So we're making two main arguments. One is that sustained reciprocity can be accomplished through a continuous conversation, ongoing conversation between a journalist and her audience members, her loyal audience members, in a Mesio new space. And this kind of reciprocity allows a continuous construction of journalistic knowledge across the news production process. That is the five stages of the news production process that I discussed earlier, and now I'll be more specific. So we talked about access observation. Tal Schneider told us in the interview, it's a crazy pool of knowledge. There are people there from many professions, many ages, many places in the country. It is priceless. One of the participants, Noam, said these are people who love the news in terms of being informed and informing others, because a lot of them want to be the first to pass something on. They saw something and they want to tell others. Another participant, you get enthusiastic about having knowledge or information and trying to bring a scoop to the group. I'm sorry, I'm reading from the slides, but there's no good ways to convey quotes. This is an example during a discussion about Trump before he became president. One of the participants offered sort of a news tip or an angle, a new angle. He wrote to the journalist, Tal, it's interesting that no one has yet contacted a certain Israeli singer about him. She was married to one of the most important people in his organization, and they discuss it. And there was a post based on that. And the journalist herself sometimes ask people to help her to provide information. Listen, she wrote, request for the next day or two if you hear or read about amazing incidents anywhere around Cleveland. She was in the States at the time to cover the presidential election. Google them and get me an exact street address so I'll know where to hurry with my car, okay? And people did it. The second stage, selection and filtering, in our study as well, this was the most closed stage to participation, but we did see instances of Schneider inviting members of the group to evaluate newsworthiness. She wrote, get this, I don't know if it's news or not, but she mentions the name of the former head of the Israeli security agency, closed all his Twitter and Facebook accounts. A participant asks, did he close them to reopen as a politician? I don't know, she says, but he's not there. So the fact she's saying, I don't know, she cedes some of her epistemic authority. She discusses with them what constitutes news. And sometimes she asks people to help her brainstorm. Good afternoon, everyone. I would like a brief brainstorming session. Assuming I'm going to the States again, what would you be curious to hear and see, and how would you want it? Speak freely, all that's on your mind. Thanks in advance. So this is sort of an interaction between the first stage of observation and the second one. She asked them what they want to hear about, what should be, and what should be included in the news. The third stage, editing, processing, the journalist shared the example I'm showing here, a story that was expected to be published on her blog, and one of the participants said, he doesn't understand the title. What's the headline? So she asked, should I change the headline? And another participant offers a title, and she adopts this title, and this is what appears the next day. Distribution stage, an example that we found. Why is this a scoop? One participant asks. Trust me, it's a scoop. 2 minutes, you'll love it. And after it was published, whoa, Tal, this is great. And then she asks participants to help her disseminate it. As many retweets as possible for my story. And people help her on Twitter and on Facebook. Interpretation in our study as well was the most common, the most open stage for participation. People had conversations about various issues in the news, as I mentioned. One of the participants, David, told us, there are a lot of people there who are more up-to-date and professional than me, and if there's something I don't understand or want to understand the backstage for, I post an image and we start talking about it, and then I understand it. The journalist told us in the interview, since I've got the groups, I've made my Facebook and Twitter into a formal place where I'm more controlled, and in the groups I go free. They know me. It's my tool. So I didn't mention it earlier, but conversational journalism also involves a certain sense of familiarity or friendship that the journalist tries to build. And we saw evidence of that. For example, she shares personal preferences. She mentioned an ultra-Orthodox politician. I love him. He's cool. What can I do? I'm also human. Private challenges. I have 3 kids in the afternoon, so sometimes they talk about their families. Confessions. I'm deliberating whether to wake up at 4 a.m. to cover the first presidential debate. Looks like I'd rather go to sleep. So it's pretty informal, and this allows her to build relationship with group members, and at the same time, they seem to respect her. That's what they told us in the interviews, they seem to trust her and they feel close to her. Now, this is a very interesting feature that we found in the group. Ekstrom claims that the interview is a central feature of the epistemology of journalism. And we see that Tal Schneider, the journalist, and group members interview together politicians and pundits. At the time of the study, there were 27 interviews. Sorry, in 3 years, there were 27 interviews. In 2016 that we studied, there were about 6 interviews. And there are very clear rules. She asks the first 2 questions. Then people vote using the voting emoji. And then she lets them ask questions. About 10 or 15 minutes before the interview starts, there should be silence because it's not clear when the politician joins. And some of these politicians are senior politicians, party leaders. There were some pundits as well, people who work for the media. And we see that people were involved in all stages of news production as well. So observation or access, they discuss who to interview. One participant posted, since the last wave of people leaving, sometimes people leave the group and then there are other people who join. It's been a little sad here. Tal, how about an interview? So she says, listen, a certain party leader has been dodging me for 2 weeks. I've been trying to get him to interview. Then there's a brainstorming session. She asks them for suggestions. Throw in more names. Think about newsworthiness. So the second stage of filtering or selection. And then they conduct the interviews. They co-construct the interviews. And then they discuss what was actually said, what's worthy, what should be the title. And one participant wrote right after a politician left the group, well, as we all thought, I don't think a headline came out of here. Maybe around, he mentioned a certain issue, and another participant says, this party leader is a real performer, an hour-long interview without one meaningful headline. And she says in response, reading you guys after the person leaves, that's the funniest part. I should add that to the blog post. And then she posts everything on her blog, including this part, including their reaction after the interview. So you can see the whole thing on her blog. And then she posted it on her Twitter account and Facebook. So they interview and they discuss what they did. They interpret what they did. They even talk about the headline. Now, this was not explicitly addressed in our study, but I went back to the data because I know you're interested in media literacy, at least some of you, and there are various definitions of that, but one common definition of media literacy, the ability to access, analyze, evaluate, and create messages in a variety of forms. So I've already provided some evidence of that, but here's some more evidence. Someone mentions a certain Israeli news website called Debka that doesn't have a very good reputation. So a participant writes, an article in Debka says that the defense minister won't resign and the prime minister will have to fire him and then it will lead to early election. Did the minister of defense say that? And another participant says, credibility level, Debka, the name of the website. And another person says, this expression can also be used in questionable medical tests, credibility level, Debka. So they assess the credibility of sources. They discuss what is believable or not. More examples, Channel 10, it's one of the major TV channels in Israel, showed a video after a terrorist attack, and you could see there some of the victims. And one participant suddenly posts, "That's terrible. I think it should not be shown. Certainly not when people don't know who the victim is." Another person said, "It's just awful toward the families of the victims. The decision to show it is wrong." And another example, an item that was published in an economic newspaper called Globes, someone posts, "They did the simplest thing, taking a press release rather than talking with someone who is actually involved in this." So these are people who talk about the news, evaluate the news, and they also teach each other. They learn from each other. So what can we learn from that? What does it tell us? We know that in the current news ecosystem, the authority of journalists is challenged. This is particularly true on non-proprietary platforms. We see that in this group, Tal Schneider, the journalist, cedes some of her authority, but at the same time, she's able to set the rules and expectations. I mean, she's a very dominant player, and people seem to respect her. So ceding some authority, but also establishing authority. So it's possible to do that. And I talked about various forms of reciprocity. So we can see here the direct reciprocity. The audience members give her payment and what Seth Lewis calls information gifts, sometimes specific things that she requests, and they get the opportunity to be involved in the news. They are invited to the backstage of news production. They interview politicians. We also see indirect reciprocity because members of the group share things with each other. Sometimes she's not involved in the discussions. They just talk and exchange things. And these two forms of reciprocity occur in a continuous manner and over time, creating a sustained reciprocity. And there are benefits for both the journalists and community members. Now, a big question is, to what extent this is sustainable or scalable, complicated. After we conducted our study, this journalist got a position in a newspaper, and this group still exists, but she has less time to be involved in a continuous conversation. It's not easy to do it all day. But the group still exists. But one of the things I'm interested in is how news organizations can use MISO news spaces. And a MISO news space doesn't have to be on WhatsApp. It doesn't have to be on a chat application. It could be a closed Facebook group, for example. And Nieman Lab analyzed data about 30 news organizations' Facebook group. They didn't conduct a content analysis, but they looked at the number of participants and the number of members in each group. So about half were public groups, half were closed groups. And they did see that the closed group seemed to be more to have sustained dialogue. So this is in line with our findings, but they did not actually analyze what was said and the level of involvement in news production. So there's still a lot to do, I think. And here's an example from the New York Times. The New York Times has several closed groups. One is for about podcasts. And this one is called the New York Times Reader Center Group. I think there are now around 1,000 members. And they explicitly say that to try and create a sense of intimacy, they don't want too many participants. And participants are requested, those who want to be considered, to answer several questions. So this is posted there. Please answer these three questions in order to be considered. First, tell us about yourself and why you want to join our group. What is a topic you'd like to discuss with your fellow readers and New York Times reporters? Are you a subscriber? We're just curious. It's not a requirement. Also, how did you hear about us? And then there are certain rules. They ask people not to be rude. They ask not to attack anyone in the group or outside the group. And they even write at the end, if someone falls in love with someone in the group, please tell us about it. We want to know about it. So I think there's some more work to do to study groups created by news organizations and the types of interactions that exist there. It seems that news organizations are now experimenting with that, not only the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Dallas Morning News created in Texas created a group for subscribers so they can ask questions and discuss issues in the news, though it's not necessarily with one specific journalist. I think it's important to be able to create relationship with people you know and not every day someone else. That may be harder, at least according I'm speculating, but based on what we've seen in our case study. And now I'm involved in a new project with Netta Kligler-Vilenchik. I mentioned Facebook, that owns WhatsApp, asks people to, ask scholars to submit proposal, research proposals. About 600 proposals were submitted. Around 20 were accepted, including our proposal. So our research question is, how can WhatsApp groups enable large-scale, diverse publics to engage in political talk, maintain civil cross-cutting discussion, and avoid misinformation? This is very preliminary. We're trying to develop it now. I will be happy to hear some suggestions, actually. So one thing we're trying to do is to identify factors that predict disagreement and incivility. But what may be more relevant here is we're trying to identify mechanisms for collective fact-checking and information verification. We're now working on a codebook. So if there are certain things you think we should look at, I'll be happy to hear, or resources you would recommend. Again, we are taking a mixed method approach, though there will be a content analysis, quantitative one, and qualitative textual analysis, and interviews as well. And even while I'm in Oslo, I'm getting messages from my colleague on WhatsApp, by the way, telling me I met with the research assistant today, should we do this, should we do that? So we are engaged in a continuous conversation, but I'll continue to work on that after Christmas, probably. I believe Thorsten Quandt will be fellow here, right? In a new special issues of Media and Communication, co-edited by Oscar, there's a great article, I think, entitled Dark Participation, and Thorsten Quandt, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but properly, but he says that many journalism scholars worked under the assumption that participation in the news would lead to positive effects for civic engagement and democratic life. And this assumption was too optimistic. It was naive, and even writes positive forms of participation now seem awfully outdated. And he proposed a concept called dark participation, considering the viral deceptions we see and trolling people, all kinds of manipulation and nasty things and incivility. But our case study shows that positive participation does not have to be outdated. Yes, most people are not avid news users who are engaged in co-construction of knowledge, but most people are probably not engaged in dark participation as well. There are a lot of forms in between, Well, there are people who don't participate at all, and there are people who are engaged in more mundane forms of participation, such as sharing news. And I think he will agree that we should study all forms of participation, and we should also study those who do not participate. But to end on a positive note, I think we should acknowledge that there's also positive participation. So let's also look at the positive. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to hear your thoughts, comments, questions, whatever you have on mind, whatever's on your mind.
Thank you. For once today we have some good time, ample time for discussions.
Good. So feel free. Yes.
Thank you. This was a great presentation, and I can't wait to read the article. Few things. I liked your ending there as well, because I think, you know, of course, there's been like a trend now to look at
the dark,
darker side, which is important, and that's also kind of dominating for a little while, I think, also in the kind of public debate. So, you know, to kind of distinguish between, you know, what's working and what's not working and why is this so, I think it's very important. And so I was wondering, what do you think is the kind one thing is with the kind of WhatsApp application.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's something there, you know, in terms of how it can be used? Because you said, like, how you can kind of predict incivility, for instance. There's been quite a lot of research done on that. But what do you think is, what is beneficial with using the WhatsApp?
Specifically WhatsApp?
Is there anything about the kind of technical solutions that makes it easier for her to also, the journalist that you studied, to have this kind of conversation that seems...
Yeah, I think that the fact is that it's between the private and the public helps, because as she said on Facebook and Twitter, she has to be more formal, but, and in this group, with people she gets to know, she can build relationships. They get to know each other. They can talk more freely, and they build trust. They respect her. So I think there's something about this specific space. Of course, it doesn't necessarily happen. There have to be all kinds of factors. And we've also seen that WhatsApp can be used for dark participation in the elections in Brazil, for example. So it could be used for dark participation. It could be used for a positive one. But I think that this MISA new space may help. And, of course, social norms, and this is one of the things we want to look at in the new study, the combination of platform affordances and social norms. Mm. But I think there's something in this MISA new space that there's still a lot of work to do. There's still more to explore. I think there's something about this space in between that we need to know more about. But it could be used for different purposes, for good and bad. Yes?
That's the first thing, and then we'll...
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed hearing about this project. And I think
thank you.
It's challenging, and it's also innovative, and I was trying to figure out, would this work in a Norwegian context? Because I was also thinking about some of the ethical questions regarding these mm-hmm. groups. It seemed like she was a freelancer at the point when she started the group.
When she started that, I mean, she defined herself as an independent journalist. She previously worked in mainstream media, and now she's back in the mainstream media. So you can say, well, maybe this is not really working because she's back
yeah.
in the mainstream media. So it's complicated. But
yeah, because I was wondering if they had written rules regarding how to use the content set in the group. If people started publishing things the journalists said or commented on, or if it kind of became part of the public conversation.
if things that were posted, if there were rules, whether they can use them outside. We did not see explicit discussions about that, but I think they... we did talk about it in the interviews a little bit, and people said they respected her, and she seemed to be able to build trust with them, so it was not necessary. But there were cases where she said, I'm going to publish this tomorrow, and I'm sharing this with you now. So I think it was clear that they were not allowed to use it before she published it. But it was clear that they should not do it. But we did not see explicit discussions about it in the group, at least in 2016.
Because I think the moment, if the trust is broken,
right,
if someone publishes something, if she does something controversial and
someone posts about it,
posts it publicly, or if she is using material from the group and she hasn't asked for permission.
Thank you for asking. We asked her about that, and she said that sometimes people say they know something, and then she approaches them in private and asks more questions, and then she checks if she can use it. She talks to other sources sometimes. So she emphasized, at least in the interviews, how important it is for her to meet journalistic standards, to adhere to journalistic standards. So this is something she talked about with us, definitely. But a question is, why do you think WhatsApp and this kind of chat application is not popular in Norway? I'm not sure. In the US as well, by the way, it's not dominant. I know that Facebook Messenger is pretty popular, but not so much WhatsApp.
Yeah, maybe it has something to do with costs of data. I mean, because most people are able to afford data traffic, so to use Facebook Messenger is much more popular here. We also see that people are still using SMS or sending pictures, while in countries where, for example, in Brazil, maybe people are saving more money by using
Also, I did not mention, I mean, there is an emerging research showing how WhatsApp is used for journalistic purposes in China and Hong Kong in the context of political unrest, in the context of government surveillance. Then using this kind of application between the private and the public could be vital. But we're seeing here that it could also be fruitful in other contexts, not only when there's government surveillance. I'm not saying there's no government surveillance in Israel, but this was not, at least it was not discussed in the group.
Okay. But I have another one, or a comment really.
Sure.
The way you describe her, the way she builds her relationship with her followers, it reminds us very much about how new bloggers or establish a followership.
Mm-hmm.
So it reminds me about the micro celebrity theory. But then when she is, now that she moved on, so now she doesn't really have time for her group any longer. So how do they react? Because usually they would be very disappointed.
Right.
If followers, when the celebrity moves
leaves
on, then they're...
Well, the group still exists, and they still communicate. It's just not round the clock. She still shares insights and behind-the-scenes information, but... she's more restricted. She told us that she sees this group as her private asset that she created. So she does not want to close the group. She does not want to lose her followers. But we haven't talked to them now, but it may be interesting to hear what they think. But the group still exists, and there's still reciprocity. Yes.
thanks for your great presentation and the fascinating project.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the next project.
Thanks.
Really interesting as well. I was just thinking while you presented this WhatsApp case and your analysis of it about the question of power, mm-hmm. power relation between the journalist and the other members of the group.
Yes.
Especially since you use sort of reciprocity as a framework, where you sort of suggest that there's a balance of power somehow. But in other ways, I suspect there's not a balance of power because she's obviously the more powerful mm-hmm. Actor here.
Right.
But I wonder if you considered using, because I've done a not similar but quite similar project myself, mm-hmm. sort of chat interactions between a journalist and a group of audience. In which I found it quite fruitful to use conversational analysis to unmask these power relations. Mm-hmm. Really sort of analyze who initiates conversations, what kind of speech acts are involved, and what kind of speech acts do the various actors use, and how are that related to power and so forth. So did you consider power in this and conversational analysis in this in some way?
So I think that this is something we can consider now in the new project, and I'll be happy to read exactly what you did on that, because it could help us now that we're developing the new study to look at the power relations. She does seem to be a very dominant player in the group, and she uses them in a way as journalistic agents. Her helper to construct knowledge, but yeah, I'll be happy to see what you did, and maybe we can look more at the power relations in the conversation. Who's next? Oh, Nick.
Go ahead. Okay, just kind of a follow-up because have you seen? I mean, it, during the conversation. But also, have you looked at incidents when they're actually disagreeing, or if she doesn't approve of, you know, what the followers are saying, or what they want her to do, or how they react if they are disappointed with her choices?
Right, so disagreement is one of the components of the new project. So disagreement, incivility, and the way they talk about misinformation and verify information together. Yeah, that would be fascinating to look at. There were some disagreements we saw in the conversations, but again, they seem to respect her, and they paid to be members of the group, so we did not see issues. I'm not saying that it was always civil and polite. It's an Israeli group, after all. People are very direct, say what they think, but there was a lot of disagreement among group members, yep. That's for sure, because sometimes she was not part of the conversation, she did her work, and they just argued, but she did not police these conversations, but we want to look more closely at that, I mean, exactly what the dynamics were. Yes, thank you.
I sent you like 30 things you were talking
while I was talking.
I just wanted to sort of point out something just to make sure that you guys knew about it, which is that like I-38 and Politico do these sort of live chats that are internal
right.
but external, which is super interesting because you can see them and you can submit a question, but you see them talk in real time, but it's not direct kind of chatting.
It's not sustained. But yeah.
So you get sort of an interesting side,
right.
as well as sort of the chat bot, mm-hmm. which is sort of, to your point about power, the chat bot is automated. So there's no, you know, it's like presuming you will interact with a robot, which is just like the fact. I wanted to push you a little bit mm-hmm. on, I hate users. I believe in the dark participation. About sort of the epistemology and the reciprocity part of this. And I think there's also sort of like a question of external validity. Like, you know, how does this work outside of the self-selected group that is now aware that's participating in a study?
Right.
But in contextual question. Reciprocity requires trust to begin with. So you can't get to reciprocity without existing trust, because reciprocity presumes a continued relationship between risk and benefit and trust that the process of reciprocity adheres to sort of the communal shared norms.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one.
Though Lewis, Halton, and Connigan say that reciprocal exchanges may in turn lead to collective trust. So they may be, I mean, this is what they write, so there may be different approaches on that. I mean, there's probably no consensus about it, but that's their argument at least. And of course, we did not measure the level of trust, and this is something that maybe we should do in the future. I'm now thinking about an experiment we may be able to do as part of the Center for Media Engagement, partnering with a news organization and involving people and seeing, and we can actually measure trust before and after. But I think there are various approaches with regard to reciprocity, but this is how they wrote about reciprocal journalism methods, but we can contest that, of course. So you send me many references?
The other epistemological question is, and we've had this conversation over email, I think, about the relationship between epistemology, phenomenology, and authority.
Okay.
Right? And I talked about this in my presentation yesterday, but I think there is a tension that is unexplored and fun between knowledge sharing. It's a power question that's sort of said in sort of a more, like, how does knowledge get legitimated? Who legitimates the knowledge?
Yeah.
And also to the point of, like, epistemology sort of presumes the sort of observational, directional, like, construction of knowledge. Phenomenology is then the process of how we then know, right? And so I think you're actually talking about phenomenology as co-construction of knowledge versus epistemology, which is sort of like the method by which this is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there's sort of these,
Well, thank you. I'm learning. I'm learning here.
I know, it's a lot. Sorry.
Sure. No, that's okay. But this would certainly be a fascinating special issue, right, about epistemologies of news. And there's a lot more to explore, for sure, and to figure out the connections, including what you talked about yesterday, the knowledge and trust. And there's a lot more to do.